Welcome to the Healing Theology Podcast, where we explore the intricate connections between religion and public health. I'm your host, Alejandra Salemi, founder of Healing Theology. Each week, we bring you conversations with thought leaders, experts, clergy, researchers, and scientists who are working to bridge the gap between faith and science. Together, we challenge misconceptions, spark meaningful dialogues, and discover how these two worlds can come together to create healthier, more united societies. Thank you for joining us on this journey of season two. Let's dive in. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Healing Theology Podcast. This is the second part of a two-part series that we're starting off the season with, talking about reproductive justice, about abortion, abortion care, and the kind of religious conversation that I think has become very deeply embedded in conversations around abortion here in the U.S. I am so excited to bring an incredible human to chat with us about their profession, the things that they do on the ground, and from a religious perspective, which I think is a really important voice to have in the conversation of abortion and pro-life, pro-choice, all these things. So let me introduce y'all to her before we jump in, and then we can ask some questions and kind of get to know her and her profession a little bit more. So today with us, we have Reverend Elizabeth Davidson, who is an ordained clergywoman in the United Methodist Church and is Executive Director of Faith in Women, which is a nonprofit working to change the conversation about faith and reproductive health, rights, and justice in Mississippi. A Mississippi native, Reverend Davidson studied social work at Baylor University before receiving her Master's of Divinity here at Duke Divinity School and her Master's of Social Work from UNC Chapel Hill. Reverend Davidson, thank you so much for being here and for sharing your incredible work with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have the conversation.
I would love to start just by checking in to see how you're doing, how you're feeling, and how you're showing up in this space today.
Yes, it's been a bit of a chaotic couple of months. I had an unexpected gallbladder surgery and then COVID. So I am on the mend, thankfully, and doing much better. But I have gotten to still be part of some really exciting things and just really excited about all that we've got going on here in Mississippi and just all over across the nation. I've had the chance to talk with a few folks at our Mississippi Book Festival that we just had last weekend and actually got to go to the White House a couple of weeks ago when I was clear from COVID and celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Violence Against Women Act. And so it was just I'm in high spirits getting to talk to a lot of really cool people, both at home in Mississippi and across the country that are really dedicated to this work and approaching it in so many different creative ways.
That is so cool. That is so cool that you're able to kind of connect with people, because I'm sure it can be isolating work to be a clergywoman in the faith space and talking about things that to some might be radical and crazy and anti-faith. So I'm glad that you're finding community in these spaces and in people who care about justice work and like justice for women and justice for people to have autonomy over their bodies. I would love if you could tell us more about who you are in your role in Faith in Women and also what you do. If you could tell us more about the nonprofit you work with and how your role as a clergywoman plays into that.
Absolutely. So I, like I said, I am a United Methodist clergywoman. I am ordained as a deacon in the United Methodist Church. So for those that are not familiar, I know the terms deacon and elder get used in a lot of different denominations in a lot of different ways. In our tradition, a deacon is a fully ordained clergy person, but there's sort of an emphasis on community engagement and helping people of faith engage with the community and with social justice issues. Of course, elders do that as well. But they are also a little bit often more associated with like ordering the life of the church and what you think of as sort of like the senior pastor at a church and some of those more traditional roles. So I really love getting to work here at Faith in Women. Is I feel like such a great embodiment of my calling as a deacon to help be that bridge between what I believe my faith tradition teaches and what I believe as a person of faith I should be doing and what our communities need and what's going on in the world. So I have just loved Faith in Women for a long time. We've been around as an organization. It'll be 10 years next year, which is wild. And as a young clergywoman in Mississippi, I bumped into Faith in Women at a booth at our annual conference and started attending trainings. And it was just so helpful to me both to find that community and to get so many resources and to really examine a part of my faith that I think I had always kind of heard, you know, sound bites, but not really examined my own thoughts on the subjects of a lot around reproductive life, but particularly around abortion and pregnancy and all these kinds of things. And so it was really helpful to me. And then I got the privilege of coming on board as the executive director in 2022 in June, which may be a significant date. Folks who pay attention to reproductive justice may remember that that was when the Dobbs decision came down. So it was a very eventful time of transition, but really special to get to be in this role when so many people are having that conversation and we're some for the first time realizing that things were changing and that we were losing that protection that we'd had for so many years. And it's just been really kind of incredible. As hard as it's been really beautiful to see how many people do want to have the conversation. And as folks are realizing the impact and that it's not just this very narrow set of circumstances that I think sometimes people think about when they think about who might need abortion care, who might want to access that care, they're seeing how many different ways that this is rippling out and affecting not only those who need abortions or that are choosing to have an abortion, but folks that have a whole host of other issues as well. And it's touching home with a lot more folks. So at Faith in Women, we kind of our tagline is that we're working to change the conversation about faith and reproductive health rights and justice, because we know a lot of folks have probably something similar to what I had coming in, had heard a lot of sound bites and terminology about things like pro-life. And of course, that sounds wonderful. We want to be people who support life and hadn't really didn't really have all the information about what abortion's actually like, why people might access that care. What are the factors that contribute to whether that's a safe experience or not? There's just a lot about who gets that care and why. A lot of information we just didn't have. And so I'm so thankful to have the opportunity to help people of faith have these conversations about their lived experiences and also to have a space where they can bring their sacred stories and those things that are important for them as moral people and spiritual people and bring those together with their political values around bodily autonomy and around reproductive justice. So we try to create those spaces for people to have those conversations, because often you'll find religious spaces and you'll find reproductive justice spaces. And there is a lot of overlap, but people don't always know how to integrate those two parts of themselves. So our goal is to help people better integrate those two parts, to reduce stigma within faith communities, to get good information out there and help people integrate those two parts of themselves so that they can act in the world in ways that are in alignment with all of their values.
Absolutely. One of the goals for having, there's many goals to have you on the podcast, and I think the stories you're sharing and are about to share further are important for our listeners to hear. But one of the things that you brought up is the ways that the religious community, and really, I would say specifically like American Christianity, conversations around abortion become very one-sided, kind of one note. Like there, you don't hear as much about the religious left or religious people who are pro-choice or like wanting a kind of affirmative care in that way. Even though we know like American polls show that most people, I think it's like 80% or something like that. You know, Professor Jillian Frank is the episode before you, and he was giving us all the statistics of like most people want abortion care to some capacity, and most people are also religious. So like you would think that the Venn diagram is probably closer to a circle. And so I think even just having your voice here talking about like you can be both religious and be deeply tied to your faith and your spirituality and still want to have access to care around abortion and reproductive rights and things like that. And so I think combating, not that I think that the enemy is the religious right, but I think the enemy is one-sided echo chambers that create this like really toxic polarization of like there is only one way to be a good Christian and this is the only way. And I think you and others that are in the space are helping us kind of move out of that binary thinking and say like, no, we can support abortion care, we can support reproductive rights and still hold our faith really close to our hearts.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just that we can make space for that and it can be a concession can be made that we can be people of faith and we suppose, but that our faith, there are so many ways to interpret our various faith traditions. And as a Christian, but also we are an interfaith organization. So we work with our Jewish siblings. We're building relationships with our Muslim siblings here in Mississippi. There are so many others that have very clear support of bodily autonomy and that have a lot more flexibility and openness and nuance to their conversations around abortion access. I think just generally, like what you're saying here is that so much of what we're missing is nuance and the ability to bring the realities of our lived experiences and to recognize that we are not, you know, single issue people, that we are complicated. And there's a lot of factors that play into our sexual and reproductive health and our sexual and reproductive choices. And that I, as a person of faith and as a clergy person, believe that God knows that and that we're not going to be punished because we have complicated decisions to make, right? And that God is with us in the midst of all of these things. Mm. So it's really, it's been very interesting both to kind of explore within my own tradition, what does my tradition say about abortion access specifically, but also about sexual health and sexuality and reproductive rights and justice. And what do other traditions say? And I think that's one thing. Often we talk about, you know, the religious right or the religious or the faith community is anti-abortion or is pro-life is kind of a false assumption. And often we're lumping in and assuming that our Jewish neighbors or our Muslim neighbors or our Buddhist neighbors or others are falling in line with that sort of like religious right, pro-life sort of agenda. And that's really not the case. And even if we look at our own Christian traditions, even evangelical Christianity, white evangelical Christianity, that has not been the history for very long. That's a pretty recent and an intentional move. And I can talk a little bit more about that. And I'm sure Dr. Frank has probably shared a good bit, and he has done wonderful work. So would recommend any and all of his work to listeners to go further into that. But yeah, we often sort of have this sort of idea that it's one way or and that's it. And that's the only way to be a Christian and particularly to be a white Christian. But that's not what our history and our traditions teach us. And as you've pointed out, most people that access abortion care identify as people of faith and most of those as Christians. So the people in the pews on Sunday are holding on to a lot of experiences that they may or may not feel safe sharing in their faith communities or sharing with their Sunday school class or, you know, their pastor, depending on what kind of theology they're hearing from the pulpit. And so there's a lot of value in being able to break down some of that stigma and just create space where people can tell the truth about their experiences and say, you know, I thought I believed this, but I had not accounted for these complications or these factors that happened in my life or my loved one's life. And I really want to think about that. And I want to wrestle with what does God think about that? And how do I, as a person of faith, respond in the most loving and holy way? And I think that's a much larger conversation. And again, unfortunately, as we've lost the protections that Roe v. Wade provided with the Dobbs decision, I think more and more people are feeling the impact of that and realizing how many people they know that are personally affected by this in ways that they didn't see coming. Not only, again, the ones that we think of with folks that are, you know, needing and choosing abortion care, but also folks that are having miscarriages and having to have the additional anxiety of whether or not they can access medications and doctors not knowing what they're allowed to do. Folks that are experiencing infertility, having struggles with figuring out what they can legally still do. There's so many layers and levels of ways that this legislation that is purported to control one very specific thing, not only is doing harm to people who need that thing, but to so many others as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to get into that conversation more later on in this podcast of the kind of the trickle down impact of Dobbs and how it's not just abortion anymore, but it's people who are having miscarriages, people who are seeking IVF. There's it's kind of scary how religion, the religious right specifically, has really kind of bulldozed over all things family planning and otherwise, right? Like, I mean, I don't know. We'll get into that in a second. I want to go back to something you were talking about. Kind of the argument that you were making of identity and how people identify as faith people, and also I'm sure as how you identify as a clergywoman. I would love to keep this question as accessible for non-United Methodist people as possible, but I wonder if you could tell us how you understand or how perhaps others perceive you in your role as an ordained clergy who's also maybe sex positive, having these conversations around sex, aiding and abetting abortion. How does this all fit together? Have you had pushback on that? And how do you justify that theologically in your personhood?
Yeah, absolutely. I always tell the story about when I first accepted the role as the executive director at Faith and Women. My mom, who is a woman of faith herself, was very excited, but she was very concerned and just said, I want you to do what you're called to do, but I don't want anybody to be mean to you. And I, you know, was like, it's going to be okay if they are. But I have been able to tell her, you know, it's really been very limited, the number of people I would say who've been mean to me. Most folks that I have talked to, people are very excited to know that there is a person of faith that they can ask questions to. And they may walk away, you know, not believing what I believe. They may walk away still having a very different perspective. But I have just been pleasantly surprised by how many people want to have the conversation, want to tell the story, or I mean, that have volunteered aspects of their own lives. I've had so many women talk to me about their miscarriages and the fears around having to navigate, is their doctor going to be able to prescribe them the medication that they need so that they don't become septic and have an even more dangerous situation in addition to the heartbreak that they were already experiencing. And there's so many people that I think are really hungry for this conversation. And again, I think with Dobbs, so many people, it was sort of a political idea that was out there that people sort of either agreed with or didn't, but there was something of a safety net in like, but it'll always be, but like, if I ever need, you know, like there's, it's always sort of there. And so you can agree with it or not, but if push comes to shove and you need that care or someone you love needs that care, they'll be able to get it. And I think the Dobbs decision changing that and changing that so rapidly and all of the misinformation and the lack of clarity around what's available and what's available where, and what are the exceptions and how do you access them and all of that. In addition to the fact that doctors don't necessarily know that, and so they're struggling to provide the right information and the right care, I think that has really lifted this up for a lot of people and made this feel a lot more personal to folks than I think it did when it was something that was sort of, even those that didn't agree with, you know, abortion care or that didn't think they would ever need or want it, it was always sort of there should the need arise if an emergency were to happen. So I've been very pleasantly surprised by how many people really want to have the conversation. And I was just laughing with my husband the other day because we had a booth at the Mississippi Book Festival this past weekend and got to meet tons of people. But as we were talking to folks and as I was kind of sharing a little bit about who we were, it was interesting the number of people that approached sort of with caution and asked some very pointed questions about, now, when you say faith and reproductive justice, what does that mean to you? And basically like, oh, okay. So you're pro-choice. So you are supporting abortion access, that were then relieved to hear that we were a faith perspective that was in support of bodily autonomy and in support of abortion access. And I just, that's not something that you think of in Mississippi as the norm, but it very much was. And it was really consistently, probably 75% of the people kind of did that little like checkup to be like, now, when you say I support abortion, do you support abortion? So it was really refreshing for that to sort of be the norm in that space. And I think that that's more common than people realize. And again, people were really excited. They were like, oh, there's a faith group that's doing this. And I was able to tell them, yes, and we're not the only one. You know, there's people all over the country and there's people from so many different traditions that are having these conversations. And I think consistently what I find is that there's just so many more of us than people realize, and that people are yearning to integrate that part of themselves, because our faith and our spirituality are often, especially in the South, such a central part of who we are and how we identify ourselves, both kind of our own self-perception, but also with others. And to me, one of the things that I find the most grounding and helpful from our tradition that I think is very accessible for a lot of folks is what John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, called the three simple rules. So to me, these were some of the rules that he established when he was just meeting with small groups and doing Bible study. And I think these continue to be really helpful. And those rules are simply to do no harm, to do good, and to attend upon the ordinances of God, which I interpret to mean keep showing up to Bible study, keep showing up to worship, keep showing up to communion, keep showing up to the acts that form us as people of faith. And I find that if I am struggling with how to act in a certain situation or what my position should be on a particular issue, if I go back to how do I do no harm, do good, and keep showing up as a person of faith, that helps me. And so for me, it's very clear that for me, the answer to that is that we provide sexual education, we provide resources, we provide healthcare, we make sure people have what they need to make informed decisions about their own bodies and to have access to loving and supportive healthcare, spiritual care, mental health care, all of that good stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. The takeaway from what I just heard is that asking a question to you, whether it's in your role as a clergywoman or in your personhood as a woman of faith, as somebody who is tied to their spirituality, asking a question of like, how can you support bodily autonomy? How can you support abortion? Is kind of a nullified question, because it's not, you're not an anomaly. You're not, it's not this rare occurrence. It's actually more common than we think. But maybe the rarity is created through the silence around the topic, through the lack of conversation, through one side being a lot more vocal and loud about their stance than the other. So it creates this kind of false scarcity that like you cannot be religious and pro-choice, pro-bodily autonomy, be upset about the overturn of Roe v. Wade, because it's actually maybe a lot of us are mourning this in silence. And it kind of goes back to like the power and the importance of an organization like Faith in Women, and the fact that you're showing up to the Mississippi Book Fair and people are like, whoa, this is so cool because we've been wanting this. And it's just, it's not as y'all don't have signs on the highway, like spewing your theology, whereas other sides of the conversation do have a lot of kind of propaganda and are a lot more vocal about this.
Yeah. That false scarcity, I think, is the perfect way to phrase that, because it really is. It feels like the conversations often start as whispers mm-hmm. and people are so excited to meet someone who feels comfortable. And a lot of those conversations do, you know, because people might be in a pulpit where their congregation may not, you know, agree with them, or they don't know how their congregation is going to feel. And so they want to explore and learn more, and they might have, a, you know, their personal feelings about it, but have to be very careful about how they engage that, and whether they do that publicly or privately, or what books they're seen reading and mm-hmm. those kinds of things. Because I think, yeah, a lot of folks don't necessarily, there is still a tremendous amount of stigma. And so a lot of our work is just trying to give people the tools and the resources to share their own experiences and to break down that stigma so that they're supported in sharing and in being that first person to take that leap of faith. But consistently, what we find is when one person is able to share something, or one person shares their story or their perspective, there are so many others that then feel safe to share theirs. And that's when the movement really starts to kind of take on legs.
Enjoying today's episode? Be sure to subscribe to the Healing Theology podcast wherever you're listening to your podcasts, so that you're always in the loop. While you're there, make sure you leave us a review or a comment if you want to hear more. You can also find us at healingtheology.com or at healingtheology on all social media platforms for extra content, detailed show notes, and to be part of our virtual community. Now let's get back to the conversation. I want to talk about the geographical kind of cultural location that you're working in. Working obviously currently in Mississippi in a space that is both in the U.S. and in Methodist context, maybe ground zero for anti-abortion rhetoric that is deep South, conservative, pro-life. Can you tell us about how you have seen your work transition and how you have responded to the Dobbs decision to overturn Roe v. Wade?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Dobbs decision, it is Dobbs versus the Jackson Women's Health Organization, which was our abortion clinic here in Jackson and the only abortion clinic for most, if not all, of my life. I know we had 2 years and years ago, but the Pink House was the abortion clinic for, you know, as long as I can remember. And it is truly surreal to see it. It's now, you know, it's been sold, it's been painted, it's not pink anymore, it's a store. And to see that every day is a pretty heartbreaking reminder. But so I say that all to say, like, it is absolutely ground zero. And that conversation here in Mississippi, I think this abortion is specifically, but really a lot of our social issues, you know, thinking about the book festival and the writers coming out of Mississippi, I think about William Faulkner famously saying, to understand the world, you have to understand a place like Mississippi. And I think that is very true. And I have so many colleagues who have been doing abortion access work for years and years and years who have said for a long time, you know, functionally, we have been living in a post-Roe world for decades, because we had one abortion clinic, we had what's known as trap laws, which I don't know if Dr. Frank, I'm sure y'all have talked about that. So the trap laws were essentially laws put in place in a lot of states to basically make it as difficult as possible to obtain that there was still abortion access theoretically, but that was things like you had to have two appointments 24 hours apart. You had to have certain requirements of facilities in order to provide abortions under the guise of making them safer. They had to be like surgical suites and all these things, even if they were only providing medication abortions and things like that. So we had people had to be able to travel to Jackson to take off work, to find somewhere to stay, to be able to be here for 24 to 48 hours, to go through some of the most virulent anti-abortion protesters with just, I mean, I having gone and been an escort, they are like would physically push you and like shut your car door. Like just people are having to go through people screaming at them about just saying horrible, horrible things while they're trying to go to the doctor. So functionally, abortion has really not been accessible for most Mississippians for a really long time. And even for those that did have access or were able to physically go there and could pay for it and all of that, there's also a lot of social stigma still. And so having only one in the state, I mean, protesters would take photos of people that were trying to go to the clinic. And it was just a really difficult situation. So again, there are those that have been doing this work for decades that will tell you functionally, we have been essentially in a post-Roe world for a long time. So while that's extremely heartbreaking, it also, I think, kind of uniquely positions us to know what works and what doesn't and how to respond in a helpful way. So these kinds of conversations that I think people were not ready for and felt like even if we did lose the right to abortion, well, if I don't plan on having an abortion, then it doesn't affect me. So I think it has brought it to the forefront for a lot of people that were not already in that conversation. But I also think there were a lot of people who saw this coming and again, who have been doing this work in Mississippi for years and years, who I think have unique wisdom then about what works and what's helpful and how to connect with people in higher access states where they do still have at least better access than we have here. And how do we get people the information that they need? But it's definitely a huge challenge. And I think one of the biggest, the two, I would say, biggest challenges are hand in hand, the stigma just around even the word abortion, much less talking about it in a faith context and people of faith talking about their experiences around it and their views around it. But also just the amount of misinformation and confusion and just the lack of clarity that I do think is quite intentional about what is legal in Mississippi and what's not. What are you allowed to say or do? What digitally, you know, what kind of privacy do you have? What's protected with your doctor? There's just a lot of questions that make people very fearful to exercise even the rights that we do have. So I'm really thankful for resources like the Mississippi Abortion Access Coalition has something called the Mississippi Abortion Patient Bill of Rights that outlines what is still legal, what our rights are as Mississippians, and how you can find more information about that and access that.
There's a couple of thoughts that kind of jump into my brain as you're talking. I can't imagine the emotional environment that it must be to be somebody who's wanting or needing to get an abortion and being met with hecklers who are like questioning their personhood. There's a book, it's been probably a little bit dated now, but unfortunately it is still probably way too applicable. The book, This Common Secret, you've probably heard of it.
I have not. It's about
a abortion provider. She's a OBGYN abortion provider. And I think she was like the only provider in like the Dakotas and like the mid, something like that. It was like a couple of states that she was constantly like moving around in. And she just shares her story as a provider, as like she talks about how like she would be passing hecklers going into her clinic. And then one time a couple of them walked in needing abortion care. And she was like, what is it? Like, what, how do we make sense of this? And they were also kind of like affiliated with like a faith community. And like, we're doing this under the guise of like protecting God's children. And, you know, I think even as you were talking about the intentionality of confusion, it makes me think about this past election, where even now we have presidential candidates who say that pro-choice means that babies are born and then a full-term baby is born and then doctors are deciding what to do with that baby. And like, you know, the moderators having to cut in and be like, there's no state where that's legal. Like, that pro-choice is not baby murderers. Like, we're not just out here literally tossing out the baby with the bathwater. Right. That's not happening. And yet, that's important. Like, it's wild that we even have to say that that's misinformation, because we don't have enough, whether it's critical thinking skills or just lack of education or lack of awareness that like that really isn't happening. And some people might believe that that is truly what pro-choice represents. It begs the question of how do we equip people to have better tools in their back pocket to say like, oh, this isn't true. Or let me Google search this real fast. Or let me read up on the topic so that I can actually not be misled and swept into kind of this radicalized, I don't know, deep dark web lies.
Yeah, I think, and again, that's where like that nuance and just having the opportunity to share our own stories. And, you know, as a Christian in my own scripture, there are places where there's disagreement within scripture. There are places where, you know, various characters are wrestling about what their beliefs are, or God is allowing humans to talk back and argue and ask questions. And I think we, our Jewish neighbors do an excellent job of uplifting that and having questioning and wrestling and disagreement and doubt be an inherent part of being a person of faith. And I think as particularly white Christians, we often really struggle with that and see that as some kind of a failing, and that to even ask a question, much less entertain it, is seen as a failing in itself. And so just trying to create spaces where people are allowed to ask questions and maybe leave. Maybe we do leave the conversation still believing whatever we believed when we walked in, but we're able to see each other as human. We're able to find common ground around common experiences and see that this is another person who is trying to earnestly seek God as they understand who God is and what the divine is, and to make sense of their own life and their own story. And it is extremely difficult when we are in context where we feel like any kind of question, any kind of even hint that you might not uphold the party line, whatever that might be, is automatically seen as faithless or as, you know, a slippery slope or any of that language that I think we often hear. It can be really jarring and it can be really hard.
Yeah,
because you are taught that fact checking and that asking questions or having doubts or bringing your own lived experience to that is a failing. Well, that makes it very hard to do in political and social settings as well. When we're practicing not doing that and sort of bifurcating ourselves and not bringing our whole brain and experience and, you know, emotions and all of that to who we are. So that's another piece, I guess, of some of the Methodist theology that I really love, is that those that are familiar with Methodism will be familiar with the quadrilateral, which is sort of this concept that we bring kind of four parts of our understanding and our tradition to when we're trying to decide what we think about something or what we believe about something, is we read scripture and we believe that that is important and vital in one way that God speaks to us. But we also bring our lived experiences. We bring church history and what other Christians have experienced and believed and thought over the years and over different geographies and seasons. And we bring our logic and our reason, and that God gave us brains. And so one of the things that I like to remind people is that, yes, you know, we talk a lot about how scripture is God breathed and it is useful for teaching. But Genesis tells us that we are God breathed as well. And so it is a good and holy thing for us to come to that and to bring all the questions that we have and to bring all of what God made us to be to those questions as well. And again, I just particularly that emphasis on our experience, our lived experiences, both as individuals, but also thinking about like, how does this theology or this view of mine impact vulnerable populations or people that are different from me? Just because it works and makes sense in my limited experience doesn't mean that this is the best and most holy and life-giving way to understand this for other people. And so that's another reason why having those conversations, and particularly having them with people that are different ages, different ethnicities, different religious traditions, different from different places than us, different genders, whatever it might be, helps us to understand all the different ways that things can be applied and ultimately help us to determine whether the impact of something is matching our intent, which is to love God and love people, is my understanding of what we as people of faith are supposed to be doing.
I want to ask, you know, because I think the way that you're painting it right now is so hopeful and exciting to create a space where people can ask questions. I think one of the greatest signs of faith at work is that we're able to ask questions and don't feel this kind of like toddler brain of like, I need to hold on to my faith because I if I let it go, then I'm going to implode. Like, no, our faith requires us to question and to have doubt, I think, is an important ingredient of faith. And I'm wondering, you know, is there been anything that has surprised you in this post-Roe world? Like, have you seen more churches come to Faith in Women and ask questions? Have you unfortunately seen more opposition? Like, what's been the response that you've seen post-Roe of either solidarity or opposition?
I feel that I have seen more solidarity and more definitely more privately. I mean, a lot privately, a lot of clergy women in particular, but clergy in general, and just people of faith. And we talk about faith leaders both as, you know, ordained in whatever their tradition might be, but also, you know, the folks that have the power, the old little old ladies that run the knitting circle that are the ones who really make the decision, you know, like whatever that power structure looks like in your faith community. But I've seen, had lots of people individually, you know, reach out to me and ask questions, ask about books to read or actions to take and those kinds of things. But I have, especially as time has gone on and as the different bans and the different potential legislation has come up around things like birth control, around all the questions around medication, abortions and telehealth and just those kinds of things. As people are seeing the impact of those, I'm seeing more people more publicly feel comfortable and safe enough to be able to ask those questions and to be on our newsletter, to have that come to the church email address, you know, like things like that, that I feel like I have seen more of that. It would be enough if it was just about abortion. It would be enough. But I also think people are realizing because abortion is still such a hot word and so still such a stigmatized even word, the fact that they can say, okay, but, you know, so-and-so had this miscarriage of a very wanted pregnancy and wasn't able to access the medication that she needed to make sure that, you know, she was safe in expelling that deceased fetus, like things like that, or Pete or so-and-so has been trying to have a family for years and had infertility issues and now isn't able to access their care or you know, these kinds of things. People are sort of finding a way in that is maybe a little safer or a little more acceptable. That was, I think, before we were finding that with like sex ed and some of those initial conversations were a good way in. And to be clear, I mean, we are an organization that is reproductive justice informed. So we have that broad umbrella of reproductive justice, which is defined as, you know, the right to bodily autonomy, the right to have children, to not have children, and to care for the children that we have in safe and sustainable communities. Mm-hmm. So that is not just abortion. It includes a whole host of things. But I do think more and more people are willing to talk about abortion because I think that they are realizing that it is a bigger conversation than mm-hmm. they sort of narrowly thought of. I think more and more people are realizing that there's a lot of different kinds of people that have abortions for a lot of different kinds of reasons. And I'm excited to read the Common Secret book. It sounds very like an interesting and similar perspective to Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice is mm-hmm. by Dr. Willie Parker. He is an abortion provider who worked here in Mississippi and Alabama and a couple other places. And he's an OBGYN and a person of faith. And he talked about how he initially early in his career did not provide abortions, but then because of seeing women dying and having really bad outcomes from not receiving that care, became a provider and talks about, you know, having to go to work in the Jackson Clinic where he was getting attacked regularly. And also as a Black man, just you can imagine the racial and gendered things going on there. But his book, I think, is a really helpful perspective on why, as a Christian, he chose to be an abortion provider. And there's also another book that I would strongly recommend to folks that are interested in having these conversations, but don't necessarily know who in their community to have them with yet, is A Complicated Choice by Reverend Katie Zay. She's the executive director of RCRC, which is, they've recently changed their name. It was Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. It may be Religious Community for Reproductive Choice now, but RCRC. And it is a really wonderful book where she just interviewed, I think, something like 20 people who had abortions and shared their stories. And she kind of grouped them into themes. So there's some clergy women that had abortions. There's trans and non-binary folks. There's people who were teens or young adults. There are people that had abortions for a medical necessity. There were people that had a mental health crisis. There were people that had abortions for all kinds of different reasons and had all kinds of different experiences. And at the end of each chapter, she sort of invites us to reflect on how do we feel? What do we think when we read that? Are there particular stories where we feel more compassionate for or more judgmental of? Do we feel one person's voice is more justified than another? What's going on there? You know, like it really invites us to examine our own internalized stigma, whereas you might think you are and be very pro-choice.
I have a question in regards to the idea of people of faith, that kind of catch-all phrase. I'm wondering, do you have any, or can you briefly tell us about any other partnerships that you've done with other faith traditions? So other people of faith outside of a Christian space, do you see the stance of aiding and abetting women's rights to choose as something that is just Christian in Christian spaces that you're in Mississippi? Or have you seen kind of interfaith collaboration or solidarity in that work?
Yeah, definitely seen a lot of interfaith collaboration and solidarity. I would say, I am steeped in the Christian tradition and come out of a Christian tradition. And a lot of our politicians and our legislators and the folks that are policymakers and decision makers in our state self-identify as Christian and often will speak about that when they're speaking about laws impacting bodily autonomy and reproductive justice. So we do spend a lot of time and energy on Christian spaces and Christian perspectives. However, I would say that our Jewish neighbors are incredible and light years ahead of us on this front in particular. And here in Mississippi, we have some wonderful organizations. We have some local synagogues, but we also have the Institute of Southern Jewish Life that does a lot of great education. And a lot of our local Jewish community are affiliated with or connected with groups like the National Council of Jewish Women, who do things like Repro Shabbat, which is in February every year. But also, I would say our local community, I think our Jewish community tends to be very progressive and have very strong faith-based advocacy and faith-based language. It is very much not a conflict of interest. Obviously, every individual is different, and I'm not going to speak for, every person. There are certainly folks in each tradition that are going to be more progressive or more conservative or have different views. But a lot of the very common accepted, very like mainstream Jewish theology around abortion and reproductive justice, I think, allows for that. And so I have not seen our Jewish colleagues struggling in quite the same way that a lot of our Christian colleagues do. And we are in the process of building our relationship with our local Muslim community here. And we are, again, because we are a reproductive justice organization and that umbrella is very broad, we try to kind of work with folks to find like, where is the common ground? And how do we start there and build those relationships? And then as we build trust, we can get into some of those other conversations where we might have differences or might want to, sort of challenge each other a little bit more. But yeah, I would definitely say that our Jewish siblings in particular have to really lift up as being ahead of the game and being very engaged and involved, not just on abortion access, but just in general. And I do think that not having that faith-based stigma in the same way that Christians do, and that depending on, various traditions, our Muslim neighbors or others might, although even our Muslim neighbors, I think a lot of times we tend to assume that Islam is more conservative on social issues, and that's very much not always the case. So it has been really eye-opening and I think helpful to recognize that, yeah, it's not that people of faith are opposed to abortion. It's evangelical Christians and conservative Christianity.
I want to end our conversation with one final question. And it's actually one that I think come up in at least the first two episodes that precede this one, which is about the kind of the underground railroad that clergy created around abortion access or like women's reproductive right access. I remember you mentioning this to me when we chatted before recording the podcast. Can you share the history of that there and maybe share some hope of kind of resistance from the past and that kind of persists even now today?
Yes, absolutely. So the Clergy Consultation Service this was something that was really mind-blowing for me. And I learned about it as a clergy person, having been a Christian and grown up in the church and been a pretty engaged, I think, person and, studied social work in college and been pretty engaged in like social justice things, had never heard of this until I was already actively practicing ministry. But the Clergy Consultation Service is this incredible group of clergy, some of whom were Methodists, many of whom were Jewish, and I think Baptist also were among, there were several, but I think those three groups were some of the kind of core that started that pre that decision enshrining the right to abortion initially for the 50 years that we had it, or I guess 49 years that we had it. They were a group of clergy that realized like, people need access to this care. And how do we make sure that people are going to safe people who are actually legitimate abortion providers? Because as you know, people would take advantage of this not being a regulated or legal service. And so there were people that would provide, dangerous care or misinformation or would be something akin to like our crisis pregnancy centers today, which purport to provide all options, but only provide certain ones and, that kind of thing. So this Clergy Consultation Service was a group of clergy across a variety of states all over the country that would provide essentially a pipeline for people to be able to go and say, I need to access abortion care. They would go and like they had this was at the time it was in, the 60s, early 70s, predominantly men that were clergy in most of those traditions. And they would incorporate they would ask female family members or secretaries to go sort of undercover and pretend to be pregnant and talk to doctors and try to see if they were safe people and sort of vet doctors in advance and vet people to make sure that they were safe so that when someone called and said, I need an abortion, they were able to send them to someone safe and they would help people travel across state lines. They would help people travel internationally if needed, help them pay for care, provide childcare, like just this really incredible service. And not only were they doing this direct access sort of care for people to make sure that they had what they needed on the ground, but they would also speak about this in their communities and they would go and testify at their local and state and even at the federal level for legislation in support of essentially a Roe v. Wade, in support of some kind of legislation to protect this. So faith leaders were a big part of why we were able to have the access to abortion and the legalization of abortion that we had for years and years.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing all of that. And yeah, it's come up. I think obviously Dr. Frank brought it up, but then Dr. Ellen Eidler, who's been the inaugural second season, first episode, she researches public health and religion, but her dad was a clergyman, part of the clergy consultation service, and does religion as a social determinant of health. And she was like, the work I do now is a result of the work that my father did and the kind of intersection of abortion and conversation around religion and abortion. Reverend Davidson, thank you so much for being here and sharing the work that you're doing, the experience that you have on the ground impacting people, kind of challenging the narrative of what it means to be a faith follower and still want to have bodily autonomy and have that kind of that right be universal. I think it's really important, like I said, to challenge the polarization and the kind of one-sidedness of the conversation that I think we only hear one side of what it means to be religious and be in this arena of abortion conversations. And it's really important for us to just showcase that there are other options, not that it's a binary, but there are other ways to think about this from a faith perspective. So thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. I ask this to all of my guests on the podcast, but I like to end the episode with a Furious Five. So there are five questions that I ask, kind of first thing that comes to your mind. Don't think about it too deeply. It starts a little bit more heady and then it gets a little lighter towards the end. So would you like to partake in the Furious Five?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. If you could instantly solve one challenge related to the intersection of public health and religion, what would it be and what would you envision as the kind of magic wand solution?
I really think eliminating the stigma around just our sexuality and reproductive lives in faith spaces and particularly the church, I think that would solve, maybe not solve, but it would put us so much further ahead if we could just talk honestly and openly without stigma and without fear of being, you know, chastised for just naming what's going on in our lives, naming what our questions and fears and hopes are around our bodies and our sexual and reproductive lives. I think that would change so much about our landscape if we just were able to be honest with one another and were able to talk about that in those faith spaces without being afraid that we were going to be shunned or ostracized or criticized in some way.
What do you believe is the most significant obstacle that we need to overcome in the near future to improve the relationship between public health and religion?
I think that stigma and just the inability to tell our own stories, the ways that we have to sort of segment ourselves and we can be our faith version of self when we go to church or synagogue or whatever it might be. And we have to be our advocate self is only outside the church walls. I think just being able again to just like very honestly tell the truth about what we're experiencing and what our questions are and what our hopes are would be a game changer. I think it would be that would get us so far in being able to make better policies and enforce better policies just by having better information.
Absolutely. On the topic of religion and health, do you have any recommendation for our listeners? A book, a podcast, a show? I know you mentioned a couple of already, but would love to hear them.
Yeah. So yeah, I mentioned a couple already. Another one I would highly recommend is Water, A Reproductive Justice Story. It is a docuseries by Talamika Bryce, who is a Mississippi filmmaker, an award-winning Mississippi filmmaker. She's wonderful. And in partnership with Shiro, which is another Mississippi organization. And she has done one episode so far and I think there are five planned. But that is a great series, just looking at what is reproductive justice, some of the history around that. I talk a little bit about some of the faith perspective and some of the history and some of the things that we talked about here. There's other Mississippians that talk about their experiences of reproductive justice and abortion. It's wonderful. I think it's about 45 minutes for that first episode. And like I said, there's going to be five of them. So highly recommend checking that out.
And then you mentioned A Life's Work by Dr. Willie Parker as well, right?
Life's Work and Complicated Choice by Reverend Katie Zay. And I think I also see a note here of there's another book called Trust Women by Rebecca Todd Peters. That is another great one. That's just about a pro-choice theology.
Amazing. Where are you finding joy and hope these days?
I think just every time I get to talk to somebody else who's excited about this work, it is really life-giving and affirming. And again, especially getting to do that, like here in Mississippi, like being at the book festival and having so many people be really excited that we exist and want to be part of these conversations is just that's the most hopeful and joyful thing for me.
And lastly, where can people connect with you?
You can find us at faithinwomen.org. And on Facebook, we are Faith in Women. And on Instagram, we are MS Faith in Women. Would love for you to be connected.
I love it. Well, once again, thank you, Reverend Davidson, for being here, for sharing your story, for sharing your wisdom, and most importantly, for the work that you're doing on the ground. I'm sure Mississippi and just the kind of deep southern spaces that you're in are just being impacted by you and your team in such a necessary, positive way. And I mean, I know you were doing hard work pre-Dobbs, and I think especially in this post-Roe Dobbs world that we live in now, your work is more necessary now than ever. So thank you for the courage to do it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Healing Theology Podcast. We hope today's episode brought you new insights and inspired you to think differently about the intersection of religion and public health. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a rating or a review, as it really helps others find this podcast. And remember to subscribe so that you never miss a future episode. For more information, resources, and today's show notes, and also to connect with us, please visit us at healingtheology.com. Until next time, stay curious, stay compassionate, and keep the conversation going.